Welcome back to the show. My guest this episode is none other than Jennifer Taylor. Jennifer is a defense attorney, my co-host for Vanished, and my friend. Enjoy. Let's open this conversation tonight. I will ask you the same question that I ask everybody that's ever appeared on the show. I don't think anybody's heard about this since way back in like trial by jury and the first time you ever recorded with me. So let's do it again. Tell me about your education, your professional background up to this point.
So I went to undergraduate school at a tiny little school called Lamar University in Beaumont, Texas, which is right near where I grew up out in southeast Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I went to law school in Houston at South Texas College of Law Houston, graduated in 2016. From there, I took the bar exam. I did a two-year clerkship at the Eastland Court of Appeals in not quite West Texas. So I did that for 2 years. And then after that, I entered the practicing world. So I've been practicing since about 2018.
I also ask all the time, everybody that sits on the show, about their respective career fields, why they chose to go in that direction. So tell me, why law in general? Is that something you always wanted to do?
You know, it's interesting because I know you just listened to this episode that we were going to record, and I have no idea if I'm going to say the same thing, but maybe. Like, I was in debate in high school. So it was something I'd thought about.
Yeah.
But at some point I had decided, you know what? I'm really good at math and science. And I initially thought I wanted to be an engineer. So I spent the first, I think, year and a half or 2 years of my undergrad taking engineering classes.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked the classes. It wasn't that I didn't like the classes. I just started to realize that I didn't really want to be an engineer. I started talking to engineers and I was just like, you know, this actually sounds awful. So I switched my major, and in hindsight, I probably didn't need to switch my major and probably shouldn't have switched my major. I probably should have just got the engineering degree and then went on to law school. But you know, you're 20, you don't really know what you're doing. And
right.
So I was just like, I should do pre-law. I should do government.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did. I switched to political science with a minor in history and finished undergrad and then decided to go to law school. It was kind of like I really don't like this engineering thing. I should kind of fall back on what I thought I was going to be more interested in, which turned out to be correct. I like this, I think, a lot more than I would have liked being an engineer.
So what is it about law that attracted you to the field in the first place? I know you talked about, you know, you shifted. So you went from one direction to another. So what was it about law what clicked for you that said, okay, this is where I need to be?
I really enjoy writing. I think I'm a pretty decent writer. I think I'm pretty good at it. So that's part of it. You know, I think a lot of it too is the problem solving and the critical thinking, which a lot of that is there in engineering. So
yeah.
I think that's why I was drawn to both, because both of those fields require you to really have this skill of a problem and figuring out how to solve the problem and applying that to the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And law does that in ways that are very different, but it does that. And that's what I like about it. I liked, you know, and we can talk about, I've done different types of law.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually switched practices. And so I do a different type of law now. But they're really, it's the same in terms of somebody's coming to you with a problem. And when you're dealing with engineering problems, it's very impersonal, or at least it felt that way to me.
Yeah.
Whenever I was learning about it, it was, they are real world problems that affect people's lives. But
right.
What you're dealing with is a lot of, it just always felt very impersonal. Whereas in law, they are people. They're coming to you with real problems, whether it's they're being charged with a crime or they've been hurt in an accident or something is going on in their life. And it's not even always people. You can work for small businesses too. You can work for organizations.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody has, or an entity has a problem, that is your job as their lawyer to fix it. And in America, a lot of the ways that we address some of these problems is through the court system.
Is there, I guess, on that note, is there a different mindset you have to possess in order to be a defense attorney as opposed to the prosecution side? Or does that matter? How does that work? I imagine it does.
Yeah. So whenever I first started practicing, I did criminal. You know, a lot of it's the same, but yeah, there are big, big differences. I personally don't think I could have ever been a prosecutor,
mm-hmm.
but that's more of an ideological thing. There are prosecutors I didn't like. There are prosecutors I very much enjoyed. We need good prosecutors.
Yeah.
I I want good attorneys to want to be prosecutors. It's just, for me, I didn't want to work for the government. I didn't want to work to try to advocate for putting people behind bars. That's just not who I am.
Yeah.
But people who are, in my experience, who are prosecutors, they do it for different reasons. A lot of what I see, and I think in a lot of the not so great prosecutors, they're kind of motivated by this sense of almost like an Avengers style justice. Like, I have to right a wrong, and it is a really it's a personal cause for me. And while that on the surface can seem very noble, that's not really what a prosecutor should be doing.
Yeah.
I think sometimes prosecutors, not the good ones, the good ones always remember that they work for everyone in Texas. They don't just work for the one victim that they're talking to. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I think a lot of them forget, where it's like, I work for my client, but my client is also a citizen of the state. And you should, as a prosecutor, be concerned about society, about the community as a whole. Like, you should be making your decisions based on what's best for the community.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's not necessarily the decision that your victim wants you to do. Or even in cases like DWI, where, or quote, more victimless crimes, where you don't have somebody on the other end. I think that the good prosecutors will want to do what's best for the community. But yeah, as a defense attorney, your only duty is to your client. And so what you're doing is going to be what is best for your client. That is your responsibility. So there is a difference there.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to, you talked a little bit about your education experience or where you went to law school and everything. Is there a stigma around going to law school in general? Is it like going to medical school in that sense? And talk a little bit about that experience.
I don't think, it was difficult. Law school was incredibly difficult. When I started, I was married and I had just had my little one.
Mm-hmm.
So I was pregnant with him when I applied, and then I got accepted, and I think I deferred for a year because I was still pregnant. And so whenever I started, he was a baby.
Yeah.
And then about a year or so in, my husband and I split up. And so I was a single mom of little kids, of toddlers, for most of law school. And it took me longer to finish than it took most people. Law school is generally a 3-year thing. It took me 4 years.
Yeah.
I was working, I think I worked like 2 or 3 jobs. At one point, I definitely worked 3 jobs.
Wow.
I don't think I worked 3 jobs throughout, but at one point I did have 3 jobs. And I was just, it was really, really rough. I was broke as hell. I didn't, so it was stressful.
Yeah.
But it was, there's also, I met some friends in law school that I'm still close with.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of good memories as well.
Yeah.
But it was tough. It was tough. And it really changes the way you think about the world. That's what law school does to you, is it changes how you look at things and how you respond to issues.
Yeah. That's interesting you say that, because this is a sidebar, but I talked to Kim Whaley. I opened the season with Kim Whaley, and her book is Think Like a Lawyer. And I went through that book before I interviewed her and everything. And it's interesting. Every lawyer I've talked to, including you, says it does change the way you think about things. It changes the way you approach things and the way you sort of like come up with thoughts in your head. It's a really interesting approach, I guess. It does change you.
Yeah, that is the phrase that they use at every law school. They're like, you got to think like a lawyer, think like a lawyer. And when you're a 1L and you first start, you're just like, okay. But by the time you come out of it, you really are... you've rewired your brain almost.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Crazy. You look at the world differently. You look at problems differently. You think through things differently.
What is that phrase? Since we're bringing it up and we're talking about it, what does that phrase "think like a lawyer" mean to you personally?
Yeah, that's a difficult question to answer. I guess I never really thought about how I would answer that question, but I think, I look at things a little more analytically.
Right.
And I think too, it depends on what type of law you're doing. I do litigation and not every attorney does that. There's like what we call transactional attorneys, where their job is to draft contracts or produce papers. Litigation attorneys will be in court. And so it's very adversarial.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just thinking about like my day-to-day, what does it mean to think like a lawyer? It means, the other side has filed a motion and I need to respond to that motion. They've made arguments that I need to respond to. I need to figure out what is going to be the most advantageous position to take, but I also need to look at the law. I need to look at the codes. I need to look at the case law. I need to really figure out, this is a difficult question. I've really never thought about that. It's
good,
really good. Getting into, I think it's really getting into like, I think it just comes down to just being analytical about it.
Yeah.
Being, you know, trying to find ways in which, okay, I don't know. I answer that question. I know that I can do it. I know that I'm good at it.
Did I stump you?
I think you did. Going through law school, what they teach you, like you go through your, like your basic classes of the things that are going to be tested on the bar exam.
Right.
But at the end of the day, you're not expected to come out of law school having memorized all the laws. Like right. That is not what you are there to do.
Right.
You are there to learn how to look at a problem, read the law, and figure out what issues pop up, issue spotting,
mm-hmm.
and how you might address those issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess that's what thinking like a lawyer really is. Like when I worked at the court, it was a lot of, I had to look at arguments from both sides, and then I had to look up the law and do a lot of research.
Mm-hmm.
And when you work for the court, you don't work for a particular party. You're not an advocate. Mm-hmm. So you're more of, you're working for the law, like what, you know, you're producing case law. So like it's, you, there's this broader purpose in what you're doing. And it's like, you have to figure out not only what the right answer is, but how to write that out. Because mm-hmm. people are going to be looking at that document, and they're going to be looking at how you write things, and they're going to be reading into it for years. And it's just, it can mean different things depending on the situation, mm-hmm. I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I think at its core, it means being able to look at something analytically and really be able to like spot issues and find potential solutions to those issues with what you have.
Yeah.
It's like a problem-solving logic game.
Right.
That's what everything is. It all feels like puzzles. It all feels like puzzles that you have to solve and logic games that you have to play.
Yeah. I think I just came up with a great question for Dave. I'm going to ask Dave what it means to think like a historian when he comes on the show and talk about that, so I can nail Dave on that. Okay.
I feel like I definitely didn't give a really succinct or good answer. And that person that wrote the book about thinking like a lawyer probably has thought about this a lot more than me.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, let's talk a little bit about, let's go further into your career. You mentioned meeting good people in college and meeting friends, lifelong friends you've had, you still have to this day. Let's talk about, I know you're not there now. There's been some very recent changes and you're moving on with your career, but I still want to ask you to tell me about how you got into the Smith and Vinson and kind of how you synced up with them and became part of that team.
Jared Smith and Brad Vinson are law school classmates. And when they graduated law school, so we all started law school at the same time, but we graduated in different semesters.
Yeah.
Jared graduated first, and then he went to become a prosecutor for a few months. And at the end of the day, he always knew he wanted to be a defense attorney. And that is, he was blessed with this, I know what I want to do and I'm going to do it. And I've just made up my mind about that. Mm-hmm. And I'm right about it. You know, a lot of people go through life thinking they know what they want to do. Maybe they'll change their mind, or maybe they decide they don't like it, or mm-hmm. they don't know what they want to do. And they're kind of wandering aimlessly.
Right.
Jared has always kind of been blessed from the moment I met him. He knew what he wanted to do and he's never wavered on that.
Yeah.
And I am not like that. And so that's always been really impressive to me. But he always knew he wanted to be a defense attorney. He went to go be a prosecutor primarily to get experience in the courtroom
mm-hmm.
and to wait on Brad to graduate because he and Jared were going to be law partners. They had that plan even in law school.
That's awesome.
So Brad graduates next. He needs to still take the bar exam though, which is a whole process. It takes a couple of months to be able to sit for the exam and then you have to get your results back. And so
mm-hmm.
Jared is still working at the prosecutor's office. Brad has got another job. It's for Brad, law school was a second career for him. So he had a job in healthcare fraud investigations, Medicare fraud investigator.
Yeah.
That's what he was.
Wow.
Before law school, which is, that in and of itself is a cool job, but
that's,
he did that. And so he had that to fall back on while he's, you know, getting licensed. While they're waiting on this, they're working on the logistics behind getting an office set up and, you know, all that business stuff that, you know, you got to do if you're going to own a business.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, I graduate last. I'm delayed because it's taking me longer.
Yeah.
I go do my clerkship and I go do that for 2 years. And while I'm doing my clerkship, they're working on opening up this business. And in the early years, it was just the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
They were, you know, they were taking criminal cases. They were putting ads out on Google. They had a website. They had a little office in downtown Austin. They were taking walk-in clients. I think at the beginning they might have been doing some court-appointed cases. They don't do that anymore. And they were just, yeah, doing their thing and setting up their business. By the time I was getting ready to leave my clerkship, so less than 2 years, they were already in a position where they could hire people.
Yeah.
Which is just phenomenal, really. Like, I mean, if you are in that world, I don't know if I can overstate how impressive that is.
Yeah.
And this is in less than 2 years. They were looking at hiring one paralegal and one associate attorney. They called me. They didn't like interview people. They were just like, would you like to come work for us?
Yeah.
And so I was like, of course, you know, of course I would like to come work for you. So that's what I did. And so whenever I joined the firm, it was the guys, it was their paralegal,
yeah,
who I'm still friends with, who still works there.
Yeah.
And me.
Yeah.
And I was there for almost 4 years. And in that, like whenever I left, so I recently left that job to move on, and we can talk about that as well later.
Yeah. But
when I left, the firm had, I believe, 6 attorneys and 5 or 6 paralegals.
Yeah.
So they grew tremendously. And I mean, they have just a massive caseload. They've racked up a ton of experience. You know, I went to trial with them. I lost one trial, and that one does not count because it was Jared Smith's freaking, it was a failure to signal ticket. And I lost that one because he was just being an ass and made me take it to trial. And so that one does not count. I do not count that one.
It counts.
But that's my only loss.
It counts.
That's my only loss in trial.
Well, that and John Wilkes Booth. John Wilkes Booth, you lost to.
I won that one. I won that one.
Pretty convincing, pretty staggeringly and convincingly. Well, I want to ask you about, I don't think I asked you this the first time we talked, but I do want to ask you now because you talked about passing the bar. Do you remember the feeling? Do you remember what you felt, what your first thought was when you realized you passed the bar?
I do. And let me just tell you my thoughts on the bar exam, because I think that it is stupid and unnecessary. I think it's gatekeeping. I think that, you know, if you want to have some kind of test, fine. But the way that it's set up right now is just really awful. I had no money. And like, I came from no money. I had even less money than no money when I was in law school because I was a single mom and I was struggling. Mm-hmm. And the way the bar exam works is you graduate law school and then you have to sit for the bar. And things have changed a little bit, but not much since I've done it. The bar exam is offered in July and in February. And you graduate usually in May. Obstacle number one is you've just graduated law school and now you've got from May to July. So about 2 months, 2.5 months of you really can't do anything with anything. Mm-hmm. You can't do anything with your law degree. And most people are spending full time, all of their time studying for the bar. So that right there kind of puts anyone that cannot just not work for 2 months at a severe disadvantage.
Yeah.
Because these other people are spending all of their time studying for the bar. So, you know, number one, I'm having to work 2 jobs and also study for the bar. The other thing is that it's pretty common for people who come out of law school to take what's called a bar prep course, which is another class that teaches you how to take the bar, and it costs several thousand dollars. And you can't use student loan money on it. Or if you do, like, you're no longer a student, so you can't like get new student loans. There are bar prep loans you can get. They're all private loans. Mm-hmm. If you're in a position like me where you have maxed out all of your student loans, you don't really have the credit to go out and get a private loan. Like, I did not sign up for a bar prep course. You just study for the bar with what you have.
Yeah.
And then it's like little things too. Like, it costs money. You have to pay a fee to take the bar. Like, you have to sign up and take a fee, pay a fee. And then like they get you with, like, if you want to use your laptop rather than handwrite everything, which the bar exam is a 3-day exam. Day 2 is 12 timed essays. It's 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. Most people type. But if you want to use your computer and get access to the internet, you have to pay a fee for that. Mm. You have to pay for the software that gets downloaded onto your computer. So I handwrote the bar. Like I didn't Hell have yeah. any money. Like yeah. I did not have any money.
Yeah.
And so I'm in this separate little corner of like 20 or so people that are handwriting all of our essays. I came back from the bar exam that on day two, and from my wrist all the way up to my neck, I was sore for like a week. It was awful.
Yeah.
But it's short answers. And then the essays, the long essays, and then there's a multiple choice day where you're on Scantron. And nice. I, for the life of me, can't remember what day is what.
Yeah.
But that's how it is. And so it was a huge struggle for me. Like, and then I had the kids. I had to have like the week of the bar, the 3 days, you're waking up early, you're going to the testing site, you're there all day, you come back, you have to study for the next day, get up early, go take the other test. Thank God I had, I think, was it my mother or was somebody had the kids that week? Because I couldn't have the kids. But so I had gone through so much. I was so broke that by the last day of the bar exam, so I had been applying out for jobs. I had been trying to get work somewhere. And that's when I had found the job at the Eastland Court of Appeals to go do this clerkship. I had gotten a call the week before the bar exam. So we're like not taking the bar yet. We're the week before. I got the call being offered the job. I was set to take the bar the next week. And then after that, it would be the end of July. And I was like going to be out of my apartment with nowhere to go. I was just going to go crash at my mom on my mom's couch and not be able to take any of my stuff. Cause like, I didn't have the money to continue living on my own. Like yeah. I was just done. I was out of money with absolutely nothing. And I got this call offering a job and they were like, you can start in September. I was like, can I start now? Like, can I come now? And so they let me come early and I was like crying. I was so excited. So I take the bar. I'm out of money. I have like, I move into this house in Eastland, which is like a 10-hour, maybe it's like a 6-hour drive from Houston. So I'm like throwing most of my stuff away because I literally can't afford a U-Haul to take me over there. I'm in this house that has nothing in it and I'm like working now. And that's it. Like I'm starting completely over with like no furniture and no nothing, no clothes, no anything. And a huge part of that is because for 2 months, I'm having to go through this like bar exam hazing process where like at least in school, you're broke, but you do have like student loan money to get you by and you can work. You know, and so it was difficult, but it was like doable. The bar exam, more than anything else, was probably the most stressful part of my getting a law degree process. Yeah. And then you have to wait until November to get the results. And so I'm working at the court and the results come in November. And yes, I absolutely remember getting that back because not only did I pass, but I made a really high score. I was in like probably the top 5% of the state in my score. So I was really excited and I was just really relieved that all of that shit was finally behind me and that I could work and I can like do the things that I had fought to do. And it was just really like to this day, it's frustrating because you see so many attorneys that you really wonder how they got here. Like the bar exam is sold to you as this, well, we want to make sure only competent people are, you know, this is a professional service you're offering. Sometimes a lot is on the line. You really got to make sure that our professionals are competent. And I'm looking around at so many incompetent people that were able to get their license and did not have to go through the hardships that I did to get it. Mm-hmm. And it's annoying. Mm-hmm. It's annoying. And the bar exam is not weeding those people out. What it is trying to do is weed people out like me that maybe wouldn't have been able to afford it or had other reasons why taking the bar exam is difficult and not because of your competence as a lawyer. That's really not what the bar exam is doing. We're not keeping those people out. And so I've always had a lot of issues with it as an institutional gatekeeping function, like what it does.
There must have been a sense of vindication for you when you passed though, because you going through what you went through, dealing with everything at that moment and then getting that pass it's got to feel vindicating. It's got to feel freeing.
It was
and vindicating.
A really good day. It was a really good day. Yeah.
I bet. Well, let's transition a little bit into, we'll come back to some legal questions in a little bit, but I do want to ask you about podcasting because that's one of the things you do. One of the many things you do for listeners of this show or listeners of Vantage still, of course, know that very well. But for people who don't, let's talk a little bit about podcasting. Do you remember the first podcast you really got into? Do you remember what got you into podcasting as like a genre and as a platform?
So I didn't listen to podcasts at all until Serial. And the guy that I was dating at the time was like, I have this podcast I need you to listen to. And I was like, no, thank you. Yeah, thank you. But Serial was good. And I really liked the storytelling format because at the time, the guy that I was dating listened to a ton of podcasts. And now I'm more... I listen to a lot of different types of shows, but I really was not into, I want to sit here and listen to people talk. I was just like, I don't get it.
Yeah.
But then I found Serial and it was more of a, basically like listening to a documentary. I really like documentaries. I really like true crime. I've always really liked true crime. And so that's what Serial was, just like an audible format.
Right.
And so I liked it. From Serial, there were a bunch of like pop-up podcasts that were like, I am really interested in this case and the show is over. So let's keep talking. Undisclosed was one of them.
Right.
They were like,
that's right.
Rabia Chowdhury was like, I'm going to keep talking about it. And it, that's a really good show that I still enjoy.
Yeah.
And there's been some others. And so I think from there branching out into, there's, I think Last Podcast on the Left was one that I listened to in the early days. Generation Y was one of the ones I listened to in the early days. True Crime Garage is one I listened to in the early days. I still listen to True Crime Garage.
Some big ones.
So some of those, some of those really early like true crime shows that got in when people really started listening to it. And then from there just kind of branched out. It was true crime that was the only podcast genre I knew existed for a couple years, and then I realized there are other things. And that's how I met TJ and
TJ Cunahan.
Some of my shout other out friends.
TJ Cunahan.
Yes. Yeah. TJ and I are both fans of some true crime shows, and I didn't meet TJ through true crime shows. I knew of him because of his existence in some of these same spheres, and then found out that he had a show that has long been defunct called Pints and Puzzles.
Yeah, great show.
And so I reached out to him and I was like, hey, this show is really good, as somebody that used to watch like junk history TV, like junk history channel stuff, like Ancient Aliens and all this crap as a kid. I was like, I really actually like that you're covering this stuff on a podcast. This is pretty cool. And he's like, oh, well, do you listen to, and then he listed off all these other things. He's like, I mean, that's because I'm fans of these shows. That's why I did it. And I was, I had never heard of any of these people. And so that's how I found this whole other genre of shows that are in our network and people that we are friends with.
Yeah, absolutely. And that brings us to, brings us to Vanished, really. Let's talk a little bit about that. I think back when we did the Earhart season, we did an epilogue episode where you interviewed me and talked to me about my experience with Chasing Earhart and everything, and people that have heard us guest on other shows have heard the story, but I want to tell it again for this show, for the audience, and maybe has not heard it. Tell me about your experience coming into Vanished. Don't worry about hurting my feelings.
Well, I had a stalker.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And it was super creepy. Somebody out of nowhere messaged me.
That's right. That's right. Now you're a star. So my stalking creates stars. So...
That's how this happens. No, I got a message. I did. I got a Facebook message from you, I think.
Right.
I think that's how it happened. And you were like, hey, I would like to, it started out as an interview request. I was like, I'd like to interview you. And I was like, I am sorry. I don't know anything about this.
I'm not going to let you get away that easy. You're not going to use that cop out. I know you don't know anything about it, but we're going to talk about it anyway. I remember that.
Great.
Yeah.
So, and it just kind of branched off from there. It started out as an interview request. You sent me ahead of time an outline of like, here are things I want to ask you about. We talked about it a couple of times off the record ahead of time. We actually then recorded it. And then I don't know what, I think you were just like, hey, I think it was, what if after this episode you listen to people come on and pitch their case and then you give me your thoughts? Just give me your thoughts. About you know, from a legal perspective. And I thought that was cool. And at some point though, the idea came up where it was like, but what if we did this? And this mock trial idea got thrown out.
Yeah.
And that was the best idea in podcasting, I must say.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, it was, it's an idea, but nothing without fleshing it out. I think it's one of those things where like, I remember asking you, I had a plan. The plan was always to bring you onto the show as a co-host at some point. Cause I knew, when I reached out to you, that I wanted to have somebody apply some pressure to some of the people that were going to be on the show. and see like, okay, how do you stand up against somebody who is not necessarily skeptical, but somebody who has no iron in the fire, who's just really coming in to do what they were asked to do with no prejudice, you know, just kind of, this is it. And that's why I wanted you to come on the show.
My job too. Like my job is to, you know, to take somebody that's making a claim and really press them and ask questions and really put somebody up to, you have a burden of proof and I'm going to make you do that.
That's
job.
Right.
Like that is my job. And as a defense attorney, that was my, especially, and even though I don't do criminal defense, I'm still a defense attorney. It's just not, it's not in criminal. I civil litigation. The job is exactly the same. Somebody has the burden of proof to make a certain claim and they don't get to get away with just showing up and saying these things. Mm-hmm. They have to prove their case. And it's my job to make sure that they do that. It was a lot of fun taking that and applying it to something that was, I don't want to call it very low stakes, but compared to like the job I was doing day to day, it felt very low stakes.
Yeah. You know, bringing that case to you or basically dropping that case in your lap and just asking you to sort of, you know, get involved. Is it overwhelming when you don't know the case, or do you just need to, I just need a little bit of time with the case so I can kind of like familiarize myself with it and get comfortable. And then we can basically just, you know, go to work on it. And
I felt overwhelmed. I felt busy at times, but I never felt overwhelmed with the material.
Yeah.
If I ever felt overwhelmed, it was usually just because I was busy, but it was never, I was never frightened of it or intimidated by it. It was just, this is something I don't know. But that is one thing that I'm pretty confident in my abilities, is to take something I don't know and learn it.
Yeah. Boy, you proved that beyond a shadow of a doubt during season one. Talk about that experience, questioning, cross-examining all these witnesses. You're coming in. It was really interesting. I think people can't really appreciate what we pulled, not to tap ourselves on the shoulder or anything, but what we pulled off.
Let's do it. We're badasses, Chris.
Well, what we did was pretty interesting, I think, with season one. Like we came in, you came in, and you know, we did this. We sort of flipped the case on its side and we did it, tackled it in a way. You're sort of like, there's like worlds colliding with, like, you're bringing all these people in from the Earhart world, and then you're stepping in and questioning them. Talk about that process, about questioning them, writing those questions, going out the back and forth, that experience in general. Can you just tell me about how that was for you during season one?
So it was really interesting because we are doing a show about a woman who was a trailblazer for women being allowed in spaces that women typically were not allowed in.
Yeah, that's right.
And one of the things that initially really struck me was that the field, or at least the field that I had, as I had been exposed to it through Chasing Earhart and Vanish, was predominantly older white men.
Yeah.
And that's a criticism. That's a criticism that I think everyone involved is like, okay, fair. Mm-hmm. But what I then found even more interesting was, not with everyone, and certainly not with most people, but with most people, I got at least some level of skepticism. Mm-hmm. Some people really took it to like, they got in their feelings about it. But I think that I was pretty universally met with, why should I talk to her? She doesn't know anything. What is going on? What is she? And it felt very like, hello, I am a young woman. I'm coming in to ask you questions. That's literally all I'm doing. I'm not holding myself out as an expert on Earhart. I'm here to ask you questions. I'm here to engage in conversation with you about it. And it's immediately met with, do you belong here? Mm. And I'm just like, this is really ironic, coming from someone that holds themselves out as wanting to be an advocate for a woman like Amelia Earhart.
That's very true. And there's a moment in the show, and it's only fresh in my mind because we, you know, just did like 12 edit passes on the book, so I know it really well. But the moment that you were cross-examining Jill Myers, I think I texted you about this when I was editing it one of the times. It's going back to what you said, it's interesting because you have, for the first time maybe that I've ever seen anywhere, you have two women, professional women from different professions, going back and forth and discussing a case, the Earhart case on a pretty decent sized platform. To me, that was groundbreaking because, and I told the same thing to Jill too. I said, I don't think this has ever happened before in this case that I've seen. And I've seen almost all of it that I can remember. So that was pretty impressive.
I don't think Earhart would approve of that. I don't know. I'm sure that on some level she would be really flattered that her case and her legacy has reached the height that it has and that so many people care. But I just wonder sometimes, like, if she's looking down somewhere and seeing all these elderly white men arguing about it. And right. It's just like, literally, she spent her whole life trying to make sure women have voices, and there are minimal women voices
right.
in her story
right.
today, as it's told today. And right. that's kind of frustrating. And it's one of the reasons why I was really happy to be as involved as I was, because no, I didn't feel like an Earhart expert, but my role wasn't to be an Earhart expert. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. My role was just to talk to people and facilitate conversation and to put people up to, hey, you say you can meet a certain standard and a certain burden of proof. And I'd like to, it's almost like a journalist mm-hmm. more than actually an Earhart expert. Mm-hmm. And the hostility that was met with, sometimes not overtly, sometimes it felt very like subconscious. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people warmed to me eventually, but still it felt really ironic at times.
Mm-hmm. I think people underestimate, there's like an audible underestimation in the show in season one. You could tell that when you start really going at certain people in the show, and you really start pressing on certain aspects of the case, you can almost hear shock in the voice of the person you're interviewing in certain aspects of it. And I've listened to the whole show again multiple times.
Story of my yeah. life, Chris. That is the story of my yeah. life, is interacting with people in a professional capacity and then being like, excuse mm-hmm. me? Like,
yeah. Yeah, it blows my mind. Again, I had almost forgotten about some of that. And then re-listening to the show for the book, it's like, wow, there really was a lot of that during season one. It was interesting to see how I don't think people realized you were going to go as hard as you went on the questioning. I think they thought it was going to be like surface level questioning, and you weren't going to be like, well, wait a minute, let's dig deeper. And then let's dig deeper in this. And people just weren't prepared for that, I think. And that was, and you can hear that.
Hindsight, do you think I was too hard on
No, people? Not at all. I don't think so at all. I think you went into the case with no prejudice across the board. And I think you treated everybody the same way and followed up in the same manner for everybody. If they asked you something that didn't make sense to you or whatever, and you wanted to drill down on something, I think you did it in the same manner with everybody across the board. And I don't think there was no ego stroking the whole time or any of that. It was just, you know, this is what it is. I'm here to do a job. This is the job. And this is it. And it was really, it was almost very cut and dry, which is what we wanted. I wanted to see if they could stand up to that. And I think it made for some really good audio on the podcast. There's probably at least half a dozen moments I can name off the top of my head that were really, really fun exchanges between you and somebody else on the show. That's what made the show. I remember getting your audio and listening to it, because for people who are listening to this, I didn't know. I would send you my audio. I would send you my half of it with the guests, and then you would listen to that,
right.
Draft some starter questions, and then you would go from there with the guests. So I wouldn't actually get your audio back from that exchange until we went into editing. So I'd be like editing and I'd hear this for the first time, and it's like, holy shit. I remember texting. I would text you like the blow by blow.
You would. You know? I always knew when yeah. you were editing something, because I would get text messages.
I would
messages.
Blow you up with all these text messages. It's like, man, this, you know, it's remarkable. So listening to that was a lot of fun, and putting that out was a lot of fun. And then getting the response that we got was also a lot of fun too. You know, it made the show, you know, a lot more fun, I think, to do and to work on. It's as hard as it was to do that season. I remember we put a lot of time and effort into season one, and I know you did too.
Yeah.
9 months or a year, better part of a year.
It was a year. I feel like, yeah, we spent a good chunk of 2019, just every bit of free time I had was looking mm-hmm. at maps and numbers and on Tiger's website and reading books. And that's the thing too, is anyone that came on the show, if they wrote a book, I read it mm-hmm. cover to cover.
Yep.
You know,
that's the job, I guess. That's part of the show. You know, it's part of what we do. And that's why it's hard to put these shows together. And I want to ask you, this is kind of neat timing, because we just finished season two officially. You know, we're talking about Earhart and way back in season one. Now we've just finished season two. Season two took a very long time to do because life, and that's just kind of how it works. But we got through Avery's out. I don't know if you've got a chance to listen to Avery yet or not, but I wanted to get your thoughts just in general. I know season two changed your life in a lot of ways, but let's talk about just the show in general for season two. How do you feel about the case list we started with, and kind of how it stacked up against season one, and how we were able to tackle it all finally?
Well, I know I'm a bit biased on the Booth series because it did change my life in some really important ways, but I thought that mm-hmm. one sounded really well. And I thought that one was the mm-hmm. best one that mm-hmm. we did. DB Cooper I was not involved in.
That's right.
So I have no thoughts. And I'm not including that in my comparison yeah. of things. It yeah. was good, but I didn't experience it the same way that I experienced all of the other ones. But the Booth one, I think, even though I am a bit biased for obvious reasons, I think that one's still my favorite one. I had a lot of fun with that one. But even working with Nate Orlowick was a lot of fun. He was so nice.
Absolutely.
And I interviewed him on my birthday. I do remember that.
That's right. I remember you doing that. Yeah, that was a big commitment that you went through. Yeah, that's really cool. I remember doing, it feels like season two lasted forever. It feels like, I remember we started, I think I told you about this.
It did last
forever. Like a year and a half long or something for us to get it done. Forever,
because the pandemic slowed everything down.
Well, we had to call that audible on season two as well. In the beginning, we were getting ready. I remember we were getting ready to gear up with Booth.
Right, because season two was going to be with the insurrection Booth.
And we had to
season
stop.
Season two was going to be just Booth. And
that's
then
right.
We had decided.
That's right.
Yeah, I guess I do now remember that.
Yeah, we were going to do a full 16 episode season on Booth and go real hard on it. That was the original plan. That's the outline I had. The guest list was all of that based off of that. And then we had to sort of stop and started with, it's pretty crazy when you have to like start with Jack the Ripper, because it's not as bad as starting with John Wilkes Booth at that time, because that time was so crazy with the insurrection and everything was going on.
There were reasons why we didn't want to put it that out at the time that we did, but but the Jack the Ripper series was phenomenal as well. I had a lot of fun working with the Graveyard Tales co-hosts.
Oh yeah, yeah, Adam and Matt. Yeah, yeah. Great guys. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of fun. And we did Avery. What are your thoughts on Avery? We got together to, you know, like, as you mentioned, you were not involved in Cooper, or you were too busy for Cooper, but you did
going
come back
on for Cooper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You did come back for Avery. What was that like recording for Avery? Finally putting that one to bed.
Avery would have, I think there, we could have done more on it, but also there's less out there. So I don't know how much more we could, like, I feel like we could have done a little bit more, but I'm not too upset about it, because I do think that we covered all of the high points, covered all the things we wanted to cover. He's very fascinating. He's probably the only major of the well-known pirates that was never caught and executed. And I love that. I don't love that, but it's interesting. It's interesting that he was able to get away the way that he did.
It's been a long time since we've discussed, you know, other than tonight, Earhart together on the record. But, you know, you're about to be, like, tell you this offline all the time, you're about to be thrust back into the Earhart world with the release of the book. And then you have other projects that we unfortunately can't get to right at the moment. But tell me about coming back to Earhart now, years later. What do you expect? Are you compelled by that thought? Do you want to come back? Is it a no choice kind of thing?
I always like coming back. There are certain aspects of the story, it's kind of turned into, you know, shit show might not be the right word, but it feels kind of appropriate sometimes with just the way that the current state of things, the way that people, I mean, just, you remember from making the podcast, how deep into the drama you can end up getting sucked into. And at some point, sometimes it becomes about not about the case anymore. And it becomes more about dealing with drama. And so there was a lot of that I was really excited to leave behind once I was finally done with Vanished, with that part of Vanished. And I was just like, you know what, that was fun, but whoo. You know, and so whenever I was kind of being pulled back into it, I was like, fun story. Whenever, like, I had completely by coincidence, several different people reached out to me kind of simultaneously. And some of them are people I didn't want to hear from. And so when we got pulled into this project, of course, my immediate thought was, I swear to God, if these people do not quit cold calling me about Amelia Earhart, I'm going to lose it. But I ended up, you know, it ended up working out, and I ended up getting involved in another project and that I'm really excited about. And hopefully we can talk about maybe in the next few months soon. Yeah. In the coming months. And then the book that you're working on, going through the transcripts again and writing the foreword and really just kind of diving back in, just reliving all of that stuff. There's good memories there for sure. And it is a really compelling and interesting case. And she's a really compelling and interesting person. And so it is always, I think it's probably something that if I'm asked to come back and do it, I'm always going to say yes. Yeah.
Good. That's good. That's good. We got that on record now. That's great.
Got that on record. It's been put out there. Right. Now I cannot say no. Binding contract.
Now you can't tell me no to my next 12 Earhart projects I'm going to have you participate in.
Would on have that- 12. Like you would have 12.
I do. I have too many.
I don't even know if you're joking right now.
Yeah, that's great. And we'll just keep it going after that. All right. Let's talk a little bit about the future of the show, and then we'll talk about your future and what you have going on for you individually after that. We just agreed upon and released the announcement for season 3 of the show. So we will be coming back for a third season of Vanished at some point. There's no dates. I'm not committing to anything publicly yet until
we have long conversations. God, thank you, Jesus. We cannot commit to dates.
Not until we have long conversation about it, how we're going to do it. But you know the case list. You've seen it now. What are your thoughts on season 3 of Vanished? Are you excited to tackle that group of cases?
My first thought, and it is what I commented when you made the Facebook post, and it's just that, you know, if we vanish, who's going to cover our case? Covering Jimmy Hoffa. Right. That one, yeah. You know, that one's got some scary people involved.
So. It really does. Jimmy Hoffa's, that's going to be a fun case.
That's going to be a fun case.
So what is it? We've got Hoffa, we've got Zodiac, we've got Amy Johnson, who I'm really looking forward to covering. I don't know if you know much about
Alcatraz.
Amy Johnson. Alcatraz.
I know what you've posted about it. So that one will be new for me. I know a little bit just because of you have sent me a few like blurbs about the case. Alcatraz is going to be fun. I don't know how you came up with that one, but that one, I was happy to see that one on the list. That one's good. Yeah. Zodiac will be probably, I'm just kind of, my initial thoughts are that Zodiac will take us a long time to cover.
It's going to be a big one. It's going to be a big one. We'll bring
it's
on
a long one. Yeah.
We'll bring on a hefty guest list. We might even do like a partnership sort of in the same vein we did with Graveyard Tales for Ripper, you know, on that. It's a big one. It's a robust case. You could obviously do it. There's dedicated podcasts to almost all of these topics. We're going to be covering for season 3. Jesse James is another one. I can't wait for that one. That's going to be a lot of fun.
So Jesse James, I want to kind of explain that one a little, because I feel like maybe you had this idea apart from me, but whenever I went to Granbury, Texas to scope out a place to get married, I found Dave and I found his grave, and we were like, the f-? And so we took pictures next to his grave, and I remember texting you and being like, can we talk about this? And so when you're in Granbury, I really want to go get a selfie next to the grave.
We will. Jesse James.
It's going to be so busy.
That's going to be fun, because Jesse James, a lot of people, I have a crazy, so you think my theories get crazy sometimes. It's well known. I think you've documented that.
Jesse James has died in like 3 different places. He's been, you know, there are so many Jesse James imposter theories. There's at least 2 or 3 places where people claim he's actually buried. Granbury is one of them, where there's a grave there, but there's a couple of other graves
him. Well, yeah. Jesse, and I'm sure you know this, but Jesse James, one of those deaths ties to John Wilkes Booth. Did you know that? I'm sure you did, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes, I did know that.
So cue up Dave. We're going to need him for season 3 for a guest spot.
I think he's got his rage tweet hat ready. He's going to be here to tell us how much it's just silly. I'm trying not to curse. I'm sorry.
No, you can curse. You can curse. It's okay.
Family show.
It is a family show, but we do drop the occasional graphic curse word every once in a while. It's okay. I'm looking forward to season 3 when we get to it. It's going to be a lot of fun. And I think, you know, I would have never thought, honestly, that after we initially the premise of the show was just Earhart and done, and it was never going to be, you know, longer than that. And I think it's been interesting to see how the show is sort of, you know, people want to see us come back and talk about different cases, and they like the format of the show. And we got a lot of really great feedback for Booth and for Ripper and for Booth, and basically the whole season 2, but the back half of season 2, especially like Cooper and Avery and then Booth as well. I think it's a testament to our little show that we can get these big, big podcasters to join in. Like we had, you know, 1865 sit in on a round table with us for Booth. And then we had the Cooper Vortex join in for Cooper. And then, you know, all these really great shows that we got a chance to work with, because our little show seems to have some clout, which is pretty nice.
If I can brag for a second, I think that one of the things we do well is, I mean, it's one thing to have a show and just be like, well, there are so many podcasts out there, which are good. And we're friends with a lot of smaller podcasts and even some bigger ones, where the premise of the show is they have a person, maybe they have 2 hosts, and they're just going to sit around and talk about a topic. And you're just like any other podcast, you're listening to them discuss the issue. And it kind of sometimes just comes down to, do you like the personalities? Do you like their take on it? Do you, you know, like, but a lot of that same format exists everywhere. But I think we've done something. We've distinguished ourselves enough and we've established A, the trial by jury thing, which is something no one else does. But even apart from that, we have absolutely established roles on the show where you are, you feel totally free to come in and say whatever crazy ass thing you just found on the internet. And that's your job though, is to be like, but what if? And my job is to be like, I don't know. And like to play this skeptical, more down to earth role. And that is the backbone of so many of our conversations and our take on things. And it's just, it's a format that really works and it sets us apart, I think, from other shows, even taking away the trial by jury thing. It's, you always know what you're going to get with the two very distinct perspectives. And I think that that alone really helps, because what people are looking for in shows is something that is different. And so again, like, I'm not generally the type of person to like be like, I am awesome for these reasons, but looking, listening to the show, it is not, we don't have any sponsors. We're not picked up by Wondery. We are an indie show with a relatively small audience, but it is a good show, I think. And I, and that's in addition to just the depth of research that we put into it. I think our work, the hard work shows, but that's also why we don't put out shows consistently, is because it does take us so long.
Yeah,
but I mean, those are the things, like, those are the things that I think, those are things I like about the show that we do.
Well, let's talk about what's next for you personally. What do you got going on in the pipeline? What's going on with Jennifer Taylor in the next year? Where do you see yourself in the next year?
I've got a lot of things going on personally, and I want to talk about some of those things. And I also wanted to play a little game. I brought this up, so, because I did want to talk about D&D just a little bit, because a big thing that I do now is I stream, I play Dungeons and Dragons for an audience. And that started out as a small thing, but it's kind of grown into a pretty significant part of my life, where play a game for an audience, and I have an audience of people that watch me play this game, and it's wild. And it's just another one of those things in my life that I never really thought would happen, but here we are.
And
so I'm not going to go into it too much, because I'm sure some of your listeners might be familiar with D&D or might be interested, but that's not really why we're here. But I do Technofunk Boy, who wrote the music for, or not the music, but wrote the single.
Yeah.
Avery's song.
That's right.
He's the one that got me, roped me into all of this. And the reason why I wanted to play this game with you is because my origin story for getting into Dungeons and Dragons was a show very much like this one. In 2019, I had known of Techno. His real name is Paul. I'd known of him because we kind of had the same friend circles, but I'd never really spoken to him that much. One day I had lunch with him because I was invited to lunch by a friend, and it was a mutual friend, so he was also there.
Yeah.
We got to talking about, we realized we had some things in common, and he invited me onto a show that is now defunct called Tuesday Suck, but it's a show like this where he just invited friends on.
Yeah.
It was very much a me and my friends type show.
Sure.
But he had this game that he played with everybody.
Okay.
And he was like, okay, every guest, I'm going to tell you what your D&D class is.
Oh boy.
And then he did this with me. And then we started talking about D&D, and this was how I really like got sucked into it. And so I'm going to, in the spirit of just nostalgia, for really just my own self, and because I know you don't like D&D, I am
it's just not my wheelhouse, so let's do it. Flipping the tables.
We are going to pick a class for you.
Okay.
So the options that we have, before we really get into it, there are barbarians, there are bards, which are, they sing and perform. There's a cleric, they heal, druids, which are real nature-y. There's a fighter, monks, which are kind of ninja, kind of what it sounds like. Paladins, which are like holy warriors. So they like, you usually picture them in full plate armor and a sword, but they're like, they have magic. I don't know, I'm not going to go through all of them. There's wizards and sorcerers and rogues, which are like, you know, the thief class. So here's what I'm going to do.
Okay.
There are six abilities.
Okay.
That, like, when you're playing D&D and you're building a character, these are like the six attributes of each character. So those are strength.
Okay.
Dexterity, constitution, intelligence, wisdom, and charisma. So for you, we're going to rank them.
Okay.
Rank them.
Okay.
And so out of, so here we'll start with out of these six: strength, dexterity, constitution, which is like your endurance. How you know, are you very likely to get sick? Are you, do you have a really strong immune system?
Yeah.
Intelligence, reasoning, memory, things like that. Wisdom is more like street smarts. Mm-hmm. And then charisma, your force of personality. Between those six attributes, what do you think is the lowest for you personally? Like, what do you think of those six you have the least of?
What's the one about getting sick?
Constitution.
Yeah, that's, I would be like in the crapper with that one for sure. I'm the most likely to get sick and the longest to be down for being sick.
Constitution is at the bottom.
Yeah.
What about of these, so of these six, what do you think would be at the top?
So street smarts maybe, or is it wisdom? Yeah, wisdom. And then what was, there was another one that was similar to that, reasoning, wasn't it?
Wisdom and intelligence are very similar.
Okay.
Yeah. Intelligence is like book smarts, reasoning, investigation, intelligence. Wisdom, that's intelligence. Yeah. That's intelligence.
Yeah.
Wisdom is your ability to perceive the world around you, be very, you're very perceptive. You're very insightful, and more like a street smart. Kind of smart.
So I'm going to go with, it's like a toss up between those two. I would guess for the okay. top spot, but my wife would probably say wisdom would be like number two, because she tells me sometimes I have issues with common sense stuff and everything. So I guess we'll put that
perceiving
too.
The world around you. Yeah. Like, are you sometimes kind of oblivious?
Yeah. My wife will tell me that, but everybody else tells me the opposite of that. So we'll put that at number one, I guess, and against my wife's wishes, probably, if she heard this. And then we'll put intelligence at two.
All right. At two. Okay. So then what would you like to put? So we have one, two, and we have six. How would you rank the remaining two, which is strength and dexterity? Those are going to go in four and five. What do you think you're better at, strength or dexterity?
If I had to pick between the two, dexterity would be four and then strength would be five, probably.
Okay. So we have you, did you put intelligence as number one or wisdom?
I think it was wisdom as number one and then intelligence was two.
Okay. So we have you ranked as wisdom and then intelligence and then dexterity.
Yeah.
Okay. So our contenders. You could be a druid.
Okay.
So we're going to narrow these down based on the stats.
All right.
So druids are, their primary ability is wisdom, but they're also very good at intelligence.
Okay.
Monks though are also very good at dexterity and wisdom, but intelligence is not as high up there. So maybe less compatible with a monk.
Okay.
Rangers are kind of similar with the dexterity and the wisdom, but with not the intelligence really isn't a part of this.
Okay.
So a wizard has intelligence and wisdom right up there.
A wizard.
So I think we have to really pick between a wizard and a druid. I think that these are the ones we're picking between now. So druids, let's give you like kind of an overview. They get their power from nature. Mm-hmm. So in D&D, magic users, each magic user class draws their magic from a different source. Mm. So druids draw their magic from nature and balance. And they're very like, very hippie, as one would imagine.
Right.
Wizards draw their magic from studying.
Yeah.
It's all books. Yeah. They carry their books with them. They're always pictured in massive libraries. They're very studious.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the wizard class. What do you think between those two?
I'm liking that wizard.
You like the wizard? I was thinking wizard too, because druids are more, but at the same time, druids tend to, in the way that we were joking before about how you tend to believe in like, the, yeah. what if, like druids are very in tune with like the old gods and I don't know, this could be a thing. And they're very superstitious in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And wizards are very like down to earth and in any sense that you could be playing D&D, but they're just like, you know, like they're professors, I think would be a really good way to make a real world comparison.
This is a far more of an ego stroke than I thought it would be. I think we should create a new character and call it a druid, and I'll just be a druid and a wizard together. And then we'll do it that way.
So you can multi-class. Okay. For sure. And so you could be a druid wizard.
There you go.
So you're a druid wizard. Whenever I played this game on the show, we determined that I was a warlock. And so warlocks get their power from bargaining with a deity, usually an evil deity.
I knew it.
And
so, I knew it.
So my first thought when they told me this, I was like, so what you're saying is I sold my soul for powers. This does kind of describe every lawyer I've ever known. So
Yep. Boy, they hit the nail on the head with that one, didn't they?
Yeah, I've never actually played as a warlock since playing this game. So yeah, that was the fun game I wanted to play with you as kind of a callback to how I got into D&D. Awesome. I was on a show very much like this. Yeah. But yeah, so once that I played that game with them, they were like, cool. And then I was like, so does this mean we're going to play? And they were like,
yeah. And now you do.
And now we do. Yeah. Now we do. Techno taught me how to play D&D. And now I'm a dungeon master for two games. I stream both of them. Mm-hmm. But then Techno also streams his games. And so I'm a recurring player on Techno Funkboy's Twitch channel. And I now have my own. That's kind of slow right now because I've kind of put it on pause mm-hmm. because I'm getting married in about a month.
Congratulations. So,
thank you. Yeah. Thank you. But yeah, that is a huge part of my life now. So now not only do I podcast and lawyer, I play a role-playing game on the internet for an audience, mm-hmm. which is probably the nerdiest thing I've ever done in my life.
Yeah, you went full nerd on
that.
It's
really fun.
Yeah, that's great.
I really did. And it's really fun. It's really fun. I play with some of our friends. I play with Rob Christofferson.
Rob Christofferson. Yeah, I see that. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And Brian Hasty yeah. plays with us as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's cool. That's cool. Well, I mean, it's been interesting since I've met you, the transition. We talked about this offline, but the transition for you has been, I mean, you've blown up, I think. I mean, I told you that. I get credit for this, goddammit, because I told you that the first time we ever sat down on a call. I was like, you're going to be a star.
I don't know if I've reached stardom levels quite yet.
I really believe you're on the way up. You're getting there. And I think people listening to this thinking, what the hell is he talking about? Well, I think in about 6 months, come back to this episode and you'll know what I'm talking about. You're going to be a star. I think it's just getting started for you. I really do. So I'm happy to know you. Like I said, I got one more question for you, and then we're going to turn the tables and run a quick rapid fire set of questions to get out of here tonight before we do. And then we'll wrap up the show. Right. Sound good?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. The overarching theme for season two of the show is failure, dealing with failure. We've talked a little bit about that tonight, mm-hmm. dealing with roadblocks, obstacles, mm-hmm. overcoming those. I want you to just tell me your thoughts on, and you can make this personal or not, it's up to you, but talk to me a little bit about failure, how you've overcome doors slamming in your face, any kind of rejection you've ever mm-hmm. gotten professionally, non-professionally, whatever it is. Tell me about dealing with failure. What do you do? How do you handle it?
You know, something that I've a pattern, I think I've noticed when it comes to dealing with either failure or opportunities closing, doors closing, is you always, when you're in the moment, there's always something that you feel like you want so much. And sometimes, because people are like this, we tend to think that, oh, this is so right. This is meant to be. Whether it's a job that you're applying for or a relationship that you really want to work out or whatever it is, we as humans tend to kind of place ourselves on this divine path of like, no, I really want this. And because I really want this, I have a feeling like this is the most important thing. And if I don't get it, you know, everything that I had planned for myself is just over. And what am I going to do? And I've probably felt that way so many different times in so many different contexts, whether it's mm-hmm. personal or professional or whatever. And then something happens and really shuts that down for you. And this future that you thought that you had, or that you had envisioned for yourself, no longer exists. Mm-hmm. At that point, it sucks. But universally, like, I've never not had this happen. You keep going, you do whatever, you know, you pick up the pieces, you move on. And looking back, you're always so thankful that mm-hmm. it didn't work out the way you wanted it to so much in that moment. Mm-hmm. And so I've always been a big believer in everything happens for a reason. And when we make mistakes, or when something is not given to us, something is taken from us, I've always... And this usually helps me get through it in the moment too, when I'm going through it, when it's happening. It's just like, there's a reason why you're not going down this path anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, just for me, that brings me comfort because I'm, and I think part of that too, maybe part of that is bias as well, because I'm very happy right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I've recently gone through a lot of changes myself in my life of like, I think as a more recent example, I switched from being a criminal defense attorney to now I'm working in civil construction litigation, which is very different line of work. And I'm sure that you remember, I used to talk about how I thought that I was meant to be doing this. Mm-hmm. And I was put on this earth to defend those accused. I really had this very passionate view of this is who I am. And I really made that a part of my identity.
Mm.
And so whenever I started having doubts about whether this is really something I can do or I can handle, and I started really thinking about whether this is for me, a lot of it had to do with burnout and stress. And I mean, there's a lot of secondary trauma that you have to deal with, and you're constantly like working with clients, you have those kinds of issues. And I started having second thoughts about continuing on that career path.
Yeah.
There are these things that you tell yourself of like, I have made this so much of an identity, of my own identity, that it does very much feel like a failure to back out and go do something else.
Mm.
And I had to work through that a lot of like, what are people going to think? And, you know, this is who I am. Am I admitting defeat in a way?
Mm.
But I went through, you know, I did change careers. I'm much, much happier now.
Yeah.
And I think just looking back, you always have to understand that every experience that you have matters.
Yeah.
And I'm never, ever, ever going to regret the years that I put into that old job and what I did, and you know, even the defeats that I had professionally, and how hard it was, and times when I really felt like I could have done better, times when I felt like I couldn't do enough, or even the feeling of defeat that I had of just, nope, and I don't like using the word give up because I don't feel like I gave up, but that is how it felt in the moment. Like, I'm giving up. I'm not doing this anymore. Like, all of those feelings are very, very valid. And all of it, I think it meant something to me and it taught me something. And and maybe this is very like esoteric of me, but I do feel like all of it happened for a reason. I had every experience I had for a reason, and it all led me here.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of how I feel about failure, is that there really truly aren't failures. And it sounds very cliche, but they aren't failures. They're learning experiences. And that sounds so dumb and cliche, but it really is true. Like, the feelings that you're feeling as you're going through these things, those are valuable and meaningful in their own right.
Yeah.
It's not just about learning from how do I not make the same mistake again? It's learning that you can handle more than you think you can handle, learning how strong you are, learning where your breaking point is, learning so much about not only yourself, but the people around you and the world that you want to create for yourself. All of that is a really important part of living your life and your journey and getting to where you are meant to be. And so I'm very, very thankful. Sometimes I don't like thinking about some of the things I've had to go through to get to where I am, but I think it's important to always go back and remember those things. Remember how you felt in those moments to, I guess, give yourself some grace for making the mistakes that you feel in hindsight you made, because there was a reason why you did the things that you did. And if you allow yourself to remember those feelings, then it'll help you forgive yourself.
Mm.
And that was a lot. I just dumped a lot on you, but that's how I feel.
Yeah.
That is how I feel. I feel like there's no, like, you can't look at it as, man, I was so stupid, or man, I really made a bad decision there. You have to remember why you made those decisions, because in the moment they were probably very, very valid.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows yourself to really not only give yourself grace, but to learn from it and move on and really fully appreciate that you wouldn't have this life that you love if you hadn't gone through some of these things that you might be ashamed of, or that might've been hard for you.
God damn. Well, that's good. No, that's a great answer. All right.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's coming. Have you heard any of the shows this season? Don't feel bad.
I have.
Okay. So, you know about the question.
I know what's coming.
Okay.
I think I know what's coming.
Good. So you're the only one that's actually kind of halfway has a familiar.
I haven't like put much thought into it, and I forgot okay. about it until you said it again. So here we go.
All right. So if you know this show, you know that I'm a fan of having all of my guests sometimes run through a questionnaire to end each episode. This season, we're doing the Colbert questionnaire from The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Of course, 15 rapid fire questions. Are you ready?
Is it different than the one you made me do last time?
It is, because it was that long ago that we had done a different questionnaire.
All right. Well, I'm ready.
15 rapid fire questions. Okay, Jen, what is the best sandwich?
Oh, tuna sandwich with jalapeno. jalapenos.
Good answer. What's the one thing you own that you really should throw out?
Probably all of my dice. I don't actually play with my dice, but they're pretty.
Mm. All right. Mm-hmm. What is the scariest animal?
Spiders.
Yeah, that's a good pick. Mm-hmm. Everybody picks, a lot of people picks. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's the first spider we've had chosen this season, but it's the most obvious.
Nightmares about spiders, where the spider is not even doing anything but being a spider, and I will like wake up in sweats. I don't like spiders.
Yeah, you should meet my sister-in-law. It's hilarious when she sees a spider. Okay, apples or oranges?
Oranges.
All right. Have you ever asked someone for their autograph, and who was it?
I don't think so. I might have told you I want you to autograph the book
right.
that you're writing
right.
and send me a signed copy of the book.
Right.
No.
Okay.
Dave asked for Michael Kaufman's autograph when we had dinner with him, and he addressed it to me and Dave, which I thought was sweet. Oh. But I was not the one that made the request.
Very cool.
Michael Kaufman wrote a book about John.
Sure. Yeah. I know it well. What do you think happens when we die?
That's a very loaded question. I think that part of us lives on, but I don't think we're going to be able to retain like memories of our life the way you kind of imagine like ghosts do, like in movies. Mm-hmm. I think that your essence continues, but I do think you're going to lose a lot of yourself when you make that transition.
Yeah. That's a good answer. What's your favorite action movie?
Do television shows count?
Sure.
Can I say a television show?
Sure.
So I don't watch action movies, and so the closest I can get to it is what is the Marvel TV show with Hawkeye?
Oh, Hawkeye.
Is it just called Hawkeye?
Hawkeye.
That one?
Yeah.
That one? That's about as action-y as I get. That's the closest action thing I got to.
Okay. Well, I'll allow that. That's a good pick. Hawkeye was good. What's your favorite smell?
What's your favorite smell? Mm-hmm. Apple pie, which I realized I said oranges earlier between apples and oranges.
Yeah.
But apple pie.
That's a good one. Apple pie is a good one. Yeah. All right. What about the opposite? Yeah. What's your least favorite smell?
I do not like the smell of like pretty much any animal feces, which makes it hard to own an animal and clean up after them. Mm. Like whenever the Atticus goes too long without cleaning our hamster's cage, I'm just like, either move this or clean it before I throw something.
Yeah, so that's a good pick.
I don't like animal feces.
Yeah, I remember hamster cage as well. All right, is exercise worth it?
So it's a good stress reliever. I don't do it as much as I should, but yes, I think it is worth it. I think that if you hate exercise, which I do,
mm-hmm.
you should work to try to find something that gets you moving, even only just a little bit, something that you do enjoy, because guaranteed there's going to be at least one thing out there that you will bring you joy and that will require moving your body.
Right. Okay. When it comes to water, this is a very divisive one. When it comes to water, flat or sparkling?
Oh, flat. I don't like sparkling water.
Good. There is only one right answer to that question. So I'm glad you team flat.
Yeah.
All right. What is the most used app on your phone?
On my phone, the most used app. I'm going to check. You can actually check.
This is a very lawyer answer you're about to give.
I'm going to go into my settings. That way I can't make myself look better. Let's see. You go into, screen time?
Yeah.
Go into screen time. What is the most used app? Wingspan. It's a game.
Okay. We'll cut this together, but I'm going to do it too now. I didn't even know you could do that. What's the most?
Yeah. You could go to settings.
Oh,
go
to this isn't good. TikTok.
Screen time. Oh, caught.
Yep.
Caught. Yep. Caught.
It's public record now.
I don't have TikTok, but I do get caught up on the reels and Instagram.
Don't get TikTok. It'll ruin your life.
I did have it, and I was getting, that was probably the only social media app I've ever truly been addicted to is the scrolling through the TikTok. And so I had to take it off.
Yep.
But mine currently is Wingspan. It's a bird themed card game that Dave and I play.
God, that's so hard, nerd. Okay. I like it though. your inner nerd is really showing through in this conversation. Okay. This is a hard one. This might be the hardest one, actually. You only get one song to listen to for the rest of your life. Tell me what that song is.
The rest of my life. So here's why this question is hard. Because everyone's favorite song is usually in flux.
I know.
You'll have a favorite song for 2 weeks and then you'll get tired of it.
I know. It's an unfair question. But you know, there's people that have timeless songs or whatever that they always can go back to or never get tired of listening to. I'll accept that as an answer too.
Right. So yeah. And so that's, I feel like when you're answering a question like that, it has to be something that you know you're never going to get tired of.
Yeah.
And so like right now I'm a big Taylor Swift fan, but I'm not going to pick a Taylor Swift song, even though I love Taylor Swift, because I know that if I listen to like one song on repeat, I'm going to hate it. these timeless type songs mm-hmm. are things like, we actually just went through like a 90s playlist in the car, me and Dave, the other day, and we were listening, not just 90s songs, we were listening to like old nostalgia songs. And I have to say, Africa by Toto, I'm never going to get tired of that song. Yeah. I'm never going to not like that song.
It's so good live too, if you like YouTube the live versions. Oh my God, it's even better. Yeah.
Because also, this song has so many variations that I feel like if someone told me you can only listen to this song, there's enough variation, so many different covers, so many different like different ways you can listen to it that you could probably get away with like switching it up a little. Like,
yeah, interesting loophole. Interesting legal loophole you just chose to get through there.
This is what I do. Yeah. I have.
Yeah, no one's ever found a legal loophole in the questions before. That's pretty good. All right.
Africa by Toto has so many versions.
Africa by Toto. That's a hell of a pick, and I'm not just agreeing with you. I really believe.
I think I won on that one. Did I? I don't know what the other answers were, but I don't know how I didn't win.
You might have. There's some that game. There's been some deep cuts pretty so far this season on the show. People picking some really interesting songs. So, but that's a. I might agree with you on that one. I think two more questions. Tell me something that you used to value, that you no longer value today.
Oh, that's an interesting one.
Yeah.
What people think about me.
We have the same answer to that question. Mine was other people's opinions. That was my answer.
Yeah. I value other people's opinions, but not their value judgments on my life choices.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good one. Okay. Last question of the night. Describe the rest of your life in 5 words. It doesn't have to be a sentence.
So can I pick 5 like adjectives?
Yep, sure can.
Describe the rest of my life. So like my future in 5 adjectives. Let's see. Obviously, this is aspirational. So I would like to say calm, happy, successful, chaotic, and fun.
Good picks.
Yeah.
Good picks.
That's my hope for the rest of my life.
Good picks. Okay. Well, before we get out of here tonight, before we stop this conversation, stop recording, tell us where everybody can follow you online, you know, what you do with Twitch, what you do with everything you do. Plug everything, please.
Yeah. So as far as online goes, Twitter is where I spend most of my social media time. My main account is at TheGen2615. But I also have a nerd account where I will post what I'm like, my projects and things that I'm up to. And that's at DiceJillGen. You can obviously find me on Vanished. I'm a co-host of Vanished.
Whoop-de-whoop.
Whoop-de-whoop. I stream on twitch.tv/DiceJailGen. Right now, it's a bit of a lull. But if you're listening to this later, I tend to stream Dungeons & Dragons every other Saturday. And I will start playing more Switch games during the week. I used to do that a lot and I've kind of taken a break, but that's where you can find my Twitch stream. I am also a player on a couple of actual play Dungeons and Dragons podcasts. One of them is Rob Christofferson's Rolling Through the Realms. Another one is Techno Funk Boys Order of Podcasters, as well as Techno Funk Boys Mont Blanc's Hunters, which is a Final Fantasy themed game that I play in. So those are the places that you can find me.
All right. Well, let's get out of here. This has been always fun to record with you in any capacity. And I appreciate you guesting on the show, coming onto this little show I have. And I look forward to what you're going to do. I look forward to working with you. Season 3, we have so much in the pipeline to collectively and individually. So thanks for being my friend. I appreciate it always.
Thank you for being my friend, Chris. This has been great. It's fun.
Another conversation behind us. Thanks for hanging out with me and my friends. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media as we post each new conversation as they air. News, show information, and more. Go to facebook.com/meandmyfriendspod. On Twitter, you can search the handle meandmyfriendspod. And on Instagram, search the handle meandmyfriendspod. If you enjoyed the conversation tonight, please do me a favor and head to Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcatcher and rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Me and My Friends is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by me, Chris Williamson. The show's music is created and performed by producer Riddiman. The opinions on Me and My Friends are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. Any audio clips used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of education and entertainment, and no infringement is ever intended. Me and My Friends is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Me and My Friends is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2022. All rights reserved.